assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Oh, today we're trying to channel it.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
We're joined with, by a distinguished group who've come to take on various issues with regard to Katrina and the response. The plan is to have each of them give a 10-minute presentation. Afterwards, we'll give the panelists a chance to ask questions of each other, and then we'll open it up for questions from the floor. If there's not enough time for everyone to have their questions presented formally, we do invite you to stay after for a reception. The panelists will be available, and you're very much encouraged to bring your questions to them at that time. The first speaker this afternoon will be the Honorable, the Mayor of Santa Barbara, Marty Bloom. She's sitting at the far end of the table, and if I can, I'll make a quick introduction and then ask you to come to the podium for the televising. Mayor Bloom has a long record of public service, including 2 terms on the City Council and 6 years on the City Planning Commission. She is a former president of the Santa Barbara Teachers Association, the League of Women's Voters, the Public Education Fund, and the Tri-County Task Force on the Environment. She has served on the boards of many community organizations, including the Homeless Day Center, Partners in Education, and the Women's Political Committee. In 1976, Mayor Bloom returned to school, earning a JD degree from Loyola University. She then practiced law in Santa Barbara, first at Legal Aid and then in private practice. And it is truly an honor to have her here speaking today and entertaining questions. Please join me in welcoming Mayor Marty Bloom.
Well, thank you very much, and those indeed were moving pictures, and your testimony, too, is really something. I have had the privilege of talking to a mayor down in the South, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, but it is humbling for all of us to see what nature can do to us and to our country. I want to thank the Department of Black Studies for putting this on, and for Chris, too, for calling me. I'm going to start by just saying what mayors ordinarily do in ordinary circumstances, and that is we take care of our cities. We work with our residents in providing sewers and streets, and it's pretty straightforward stuff. Potholes don't have an R or a D on them, I always say. We're pretty nonpartisan out here in California, and I think in general that's what mayors do, is fix potholes, trim trees, and do the ordinary things. Make sure that school children get to school safely, and I don't mean to be putting that down or anything. These are important things that are done in the daily lives of everybody to make our quality of life the way it is. I'm very pleased to be the mayor of Santa Barbara. A little boy asked me once if all the other mayors are jealous of me, and sometimes I think of that because Santa Barbara is a wonderful place to be mayor of, but it is normal work. I have to say, when I saw Ray Nagin, who is the mayor of New Orleans, I saw him on television telling everybody to get out of town. And I thought, I think he's overreacting. And I think that's not a good thing to do. So it shows you I can be wrong. He obviously had information. But he was a first-time mayor. He'd never been in elected office before. He was a businessman. I had met him at the Conference of Mayors, a very nice man, but I think it's his first term, maybe first year. And, you know, when you think about taking care of the potholes and taking care of businesses, business economic interests and so on, that's what he was learning how to do. And suddenly he was faced with this, knowing that it was a tremendous disaster, and he had to evacuate his 1.3 million people out of that area. A tremendous job. I now look back and think he did an amazing job. for him to get on TV and say everybody has to get out of here in 2 days, and be convincing. And he certainly convinced me. I just thought I wasn't quite sure if he was doing the right thing, but he convinced me. I think what happened, though, is that rich-poor divide. The rich, the middle-income people got out. And what was left were people who were difficult to get out. But what they forgot is the bus drivers, too, got out. And so did some of the hospital workers. And so did police officers. They turned in their badges and they left. And you know what? You almost don't blame them in some ways. They took an oath to protect people, but you almost don't blame them because it was a very, very dangerous storm. So you had buses there without drivers. You had trucks without drivers. And people commandeered them, and I think that was just fine, frankly. I saw a storekeeper who was pointing to his store. It was completely empty, like a 7-Eleven type of store. And he said he understood why people took the food. I would understand that, too. He just hopes that they can build up the store again so it can serve the neighborhood again. But very forgiving. My issue as a mayor, I would probably do the same thing, tell people to leave. We have been hit with wildfires. We've been hit with flooding. We've been hit with earthquakes and even tsunamis that I understand went over the top of the... This is what they tell me, and I don't know if that's true, but it would have gone over the news press building, but stopped right at City Hall, which I thought was pretty... That's actually pretty cool because, well... That's my fight with the news press, and never mind. The evacuation planning is kind of a dicey thing because you don't know when the bus drivers are going to leave and the police officers and so on, and so you have to really make contingency plans. We try to do the best we can, but frankly, we learned from New Orleans that the federal government has turned over Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, and those kinds of things to cronies. Frankly, it's cronyism in the Bush administration that is handing out these jobs. The equestrian manager who is the head of FEMA, he had no right to be the head of FEMA. I think he thought it would look good on his resume or something like that. But frankly, he should have turned it over to his staff and said, big job here, tell me what to do. It didn't happen. And that's pretty frightening. As a mayor, to know that you wouldn't have the federal government. The National Guard is supposed to be there. They're run by the state. They're supposed to be there for national crises like this, or for a local crisis, I should say. They're called the National Guard, but they're supposed to guard the locals. And if they're off in Iraq and off in Afghanistan, they can't guard us. Our little National Guard here has about about 20 people in it, but about 6 people at any one moment. We're only a town of 90,000, but I don't know how much that can help us. And then I saw Bush on television afterwards saying, well, it looks like we're going to need to take the armed services and have them be the first responders. No, that's what the National Guard is supposed to do. They're not supposed to be over in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're supposed to be in town to help you in these times. So somehow the federal government doesn't, or the Bush administration doesn't understand the different levels and what they're supposed to be doing. And that's very frightening for a mayor to think of. Before Katrina hit, the mayors have a very good camaraderie with each other. We have a conference of mayors, and I can pick up the phone and talk to them, and I know a lot of them now, and we do talk to each other, because otherwise it can be a very lonely position. Well, after Katrina hit, a group of mayors, a whole bunch of us, called the conference of mayors, and we sent down staff for Ray Nagin, because he didn't have staff. His staff is gone. We sent down about 10 people from the Conference of Mayors. It doesn't sound like a lot, but at least they knew municipal government. And then each of us mayors, there were about 80 or 90 of us, have adopted different cities in the South. And what happened was they kind of doled it out. And I don't know how I got Biloxi, Mississippi, but I got Biloxi, Mississippi. And they teamed me up with Gary, Indiana. And think of this, we've got a federal government that's supposed to be helping. They're supposed to show up. They're supposed to come and do things. But instead, you don't have them, and you don't have the state because the National Guard are off elsewhere. And so all you have is your local, and Ray Nagin has to be picked up from the roof of the City Hall by helicopter. That's what happened to him. So what we did is we got organized, and I feel really good about it. I got assigned to Biloxi, Mississippi, a town of about 45, 50,000 people. They have lost 5,000 homes there, 1,000 businesses. They have 140 city workers who are homeless. And I talked to the mayor right away. He was in his fourth term. He is in his fourth term as mayor, so he knows what it's about. He talked about planning and rebuilding his town. So we sent a couple planners there. And one of the best planners in Santa Barbara is, if you can only name one person who's in charge, who has made the downtown look the way it is and really done good planning in Santa Barbara, his name is Dave Davis. He was with us for a long time. He retired. His family, you're going to get chills with this, his family was from New Orleans and helped found the city of Biloxi in the 1600s. So guess who gets to go there and help them plan? This is all done on mayor-to-mayor grassroots level. It's not done at the federal government level, and darn it, the federal government's supposed to be helping, and they aren't. So what we're doing is we've matched up department heads to department heads, so our parks department can talk to their parks department head, the public works to public works, fire department, police department, you get the idea. We've also matched up with Gary, Indiana, because they're a manufacturing town and they make RVs. They have a big factory there, so good for them, they can send down some RVs. And we're building houses here in Santa Barbara, which can be put on big trucks with Habitat for Humanity and sent over there. The guy from Habitat for Humanity in Santa Barbara is there right now talking to them. All this is okay. It's really making me feel good, and it makes the people feel good in Santa Barbara who can help. But you know what? This isn't the way it's supposed to happen. It's supposed to happen where the federal government helps out in times like these. You don't have an equestrian manager as the head of FEMA. And you certainly don't have the National Guard elsewhere. And we should learn from this. We should learn big time from this. The question here about whether it's a racial issue or not, I've been in the South. I know that some of the poorest people are going to be black. That's just the way that is. It's probably from the 1800s when they were slaves and so on. But it's, to me, it's more than a racial issue. It's an issue of government. The federal government has a certain role, and they dropped it, frankly. And I think we all should be ashamed of that. I think it's absolutely wonderful that the, was it Jefferson Parish that seceded from the Union? Good for them. You know, sometimes you just have to do what you have to do. I started out by saying what a mayor does, and a mayor does is take care. What a mayor does is to take care of the residents and to make sure people are safe and that things happen well. And if you can't do it because the federal government's off doing whatever they're doing, you're going to have to do what you have to do. And I'm real proud of that mayor or the head of the county president kind of thing. But I'm very proud of that person for doing it. When you don't have federal and you don't have state money and you don't have any help at all, you have to do it. We will continue. I think we will continue for about 10 years. I don't think this is going to happen real fast. I think in order to build all this back, they say they have about 50% of the kids in school that they ordinarily do in Biloxi, Mississippi. I got probably the worst email that I've ever seen, and kind of an amazing email from Ray Nagin. He sent an email to all the mayors, and his question is, can you do a census of all the people in your community who are from New Orleans who have come? I know that the city of Santa Barbara has about 50 to 60 people who have come, and they're either at their grandparents' house or, you know, an aunt or uncle or an old friend, and they're being taken care of. They're not in a shelter situation. But he wants us to do a census because he says, I don't know where my residents are. They're gone. And that's chilling, you know, when you think about it. That's why I started with, what does the mayor do? Take care of the residents. and his are gone, and that's just terrible. So I don't know how economically they're going to come back very quickly. The town of Biloxi had nine casinos floating in the water, eight of which are just completely gone. One can open in December. That's their tax base. It would be like wiping out all the motels and hotels in the downtown area. We wouldn't have the bed tax anymore. So it is going to take a long time for them to come back. But we at the local level have to help, and that's what we're doing one-on-one. It's pitiful that has to happen in a place like America, and we're a little bit arrogant about how wonderful we are. So maybe we shouldn't be so arrogant, but it is pitiful that has to happen like that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bloom. It's always a pleasure to hear your comments. Now I'd like to introduce Professor Gay Teresa Johnson of the Department of Black Studies here at University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Johnson's research explores 20th century U.S. history, race and racism, social movements and identities, and cultural history. In addition to serving as a reviewer for two refereed journals, her publications appear in numerous prestigious venues, including the Journal of American Ethnic History, the National Women's Studies Association Journal, and edited volumes on race and popular culture. She's currently completing a book entitled The Future Has a Past, Politics, Music, and Memory in Afro-Chicano Los Angeles. Please join me in welcoming Professor Johnson.
Thank you all for coming. A recent article by independent journalist Ben Somburg reveals the disparity between America's imagined generosity and its actual contributions. Citing a joint poll by the Washington Post, Harvard University, and the Kaiser Family Foundation, Somburg reveals that when questioned, most Americans estimate that 20% of the federal budget goes towards foreign aid. When respondents were presented with the actual figure, which is closer to 1.6%, many of them protested, questioning the veracity of the researchers' information. Considering media and politicians' depictions of U.S. contributions to the tsunami relief effort, Somburg writes, quote, "It is no wonder that most Americans think they live in an extremely generous nation." Indeed, in the days after the Katrina crisis, President Bush's generosity seemed to know no bounds. His administration generously offered Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root a $500 million contract with the Navy to provide emergency repairs at military installations damaged in the hurricane. His administration awarded a $100 million deal to the Shaw Group of Baton Rouge for pumping floodwater out of New Orleans and other work. America, Bush said, is rising to the occasion by helping lower-income citizens in the hurricane region build new and better lives. This manufactured generosity did not stop here. In their efforts to help poor people in New Orleans build better lives, Bush generously suspended the application of the Davis-Bacon Act, the federal law that requires employers to pay the prevailing wage in that region. And as if that weren't enough, in order to expedite the progress of reconstruction in New Orleans, Bush magnanimously lifted the requirement that contractors must have written affirmative action plans and has suspended regulations governing the number of hours that truckers can work. Republicans in Congress followed Bush's generosity by proposing that the Environmental Protection Agency be allowed to waive all environmental regulations during the rebuilding, which in turn freed manufacturers, businesses, and power plants to produce toxic emissions without pollution controls. Subsequently, House Democrats obtained draft legislation crafted by the Bush administration that would permanently empower the EPA to waive any regulation in the Clean Air Act whenever that agency finds that emergency conditions exist. All of these measures, all of this generosity costs money, hence the nearly $200 billion fund that is headed to the states hit by Katrina. So where will it come from? Bush's Republican Study Committee of the House of Representatives proposed a package to offset the cost of relief by cutting at least $35 billion from services that help low-income families. Medicaid and food stamps are two of the services that are targeted for these large cuts. This will only escalate the healthcare crisis for the very people Bush purports to aid. Mississippi has the highest percentage of Medicaid recipients in the country. Nearly 1 in 4 of its residents was in the program before Katrina. About 1 in 5 Louisianans was enrolled, and 1/5 of those who live in the 2 states had no insurance coverage at all. Louisiana's Medicaid system covers only those with incomes up to 13% of the federal poverty level, defined for a family of 4 as an annual income of less than $20,000 a year. While the Bush administration's plan does not seem generous at first glance, it actually is to America's top earners, since it called for virtually no sacrifice from the most well-off Americans by leaving in place generous new tax cuts. So confident was Bush in the generosity of his administration, and here I'm echoing Nathan's observations, that he allowed the State Department to refuse offers of aid from France, Germany, Venezuela, and Cuba. With such a generous friend as the Bush administration, oppressed communities in New Orleans and other areas hit by Katrina have no need for enemies. But just in case of a threat by our enemies, in the midst of the devastation of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the Senate rewarded Bush's generosity with some of their own, voting on October 7th to give his administration $50 billion more dollars for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, bringing total spending for the war on terrorism to over $350 billion. But this last point about more funding for the war in Iraq raises an important point about the way in which the media has connected Iraq to New Orleans. In an article titled Baghdad on the Bayou, Time reporter Brian Bennett described what he witnessed from the Pave Hawk helicopter flying him into New Orleans. He said, "The scene looks like a war zone. Fights are breaking out for the seats on outbound helicopters, and the gangbangers couldn't understand that we had to get the sick people out first." End quote. A month after this article, Bennett and others who were criticized for sensationalizing a, quote, black crime fixation, admitted that these depictions were exaggerated. But as Earl Afari Hutchinson has explained, this, quote, mea culpa came a month after these images had been firmly pile-driven into the skulls of millions, nationally and worldwide, becoming an urban legend created that the press's belated Gentile damage control could never shake. Hutchinson further commented that the media coverage was irresponsible, shameful, and reprehensible, and that it showed when disaster and race collide, anything goes, including the truth. But there are other parallels to be made between Baghdad and the Bayou. As in the war on Iraq, the main aim of this generosity by government and corporate elites is to advance conservative economic principles and social practices. Mike Davis has pointed out that, quote, all kinds of extravagant claims have been reported about how the city can use this to its advantage, about how New Orleans might even become a Republican city as the result of the silver lining that the French Quarter, the Convention Center, the Garden District, and Audubon Park are all high and dry and therefore safe. In the midst of so much bad news, distinguished as generosity, one of the issues to remain conscious of is that there is a counter response. Many local activists and grassroots organizations, indeed ordinary residents, have become radicalized by the connection between the harmful generosity of the Bush administration and the project in the Middle East. Jay Arena, for example, who is an activist with the Hands Off Iberville Coalition near New Orleans, says the flood becomes part of an ethnic cleansing, basically. City politics have been aiming at that for the last 20 or 25 years, and I think we can see that this is evidence in the comments of so many, of not just city officials, right, but also national politicians and media. I spoke with Jay Arena yesterday, and he explained that schools on the east and the west banks of the river are being broken off and chartered as the area is reconstructed. The public hospital, which has experienced cutbacks for the past 4 years, has now been condemned, conveniently. That Section 8 housing certificates, which were always difficult to come by in that area, especially in the 9th Ward, are now nearly impossible to secure. We are struggling, he said, but we are reorganizing. Last week, in fact, a coalition of public housing and Section 8 residents and supporters, including the Forest Park Tenants Association, Family Farm Defenders, the Hands Off Iberville Coalition, and the Christopher Projects, issued a plea to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Housing Authority of New Orleans, and landlords. They asked the government to stop using alleged hurricane damage to public housing projects as a pretext for cutting off Section 8 payments to its residents. Responding to these actions by HUD in particular, organizations like the Common Ground Collective has built a community center that offers free water, free food, cleaning supplies, internet access, house repairs, and a free medical clinic. in the midst of multinational contract bidding over these lands that longtime activists and residents have inhabited, these kinds of organizations are urging residents of the Ninth Ward to struggle to hold on to the governance of their local communities. People like Ms. Charlestine Jones, who is a longtime resident and activist in the Forest Park apartment complex, are organizing against the forced removal of tenants from their homes after she and others returned home to find their apartments locked, when in fact many of these places, including the Forest Park apartment complex, were not flooded. They returned home to find their apartments locked, owners unwilling to accept rent payments, and mandatory eviction of all residents scheduled to take place immediately. And this was because of several offers that were made to landlords or those land owners by these contractors. Through protests and press conferences, many of these local organizations are calling attention to the link between imperialism abroad and racism at home. This is a struggle of poor and oppressed people across the country, says Arena, and we're trying to show how the new racism works. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Our next speaker is Professor George Lipsitz, who is a member of the Black Studies Department and the Sociology Department here at UC Santa Barbara. Professor Lipsitz began his career by working within a radical union collective in St. Louis in the 1970s. This work led him to pursue an advanced degree in labor history. His commitment to better understanding the agency of the working class has led to a stunning array of publications, including 7 books in the last 15 years. One of the most recognized and respected scholars in American studies, Professor Lipsitz's research focuses on race, culture and social identities, 20th century U.S. history, urban history and culture, and social movements. His work is especially noteworthy for the way it credits the working class and marginalized populations with producing sophisticated social and cultural critique. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lipsitz.
In her song, The Final Hour, the hip-hop artist Lauryn Hill describes her work as an opus to reverse the hypnosis, a song that's designed to change the focus from the richest to the brokest. And I think our job today is to look away from the gaze of the richest, who have an elaborate plan of corporate looting plan for New Orleans. And we need to see things from the point of view of residents of New Orleans who, even though they're broke, are not yet broken. What's at stake in New Orleans is not only the lives and dignity of black people, but the future of democracy itself. We shouldn't let our government's use of the word democracy trivialize its currency. It's a perfectly good idea. It just hasn't been used enough in these parts. And in New Orleans, it needs to be expressed through 3 particular ends. Black people in New Orleans have the right to return, they have the right to rebuild, and they have the right to have their personhood protected as assiduously and diligently as white property is protected. And this is what they are organizing for. In the wake of what's been going on in New Orleans, the perspective of the richest is not hard to find. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Alfonso Jackson, one of those black conservatives who purports to be colorblind because he says the age of discrimination is over, said that New Orleans is not going to be as black as it was for a long time, if ever again. Jackson predicts, I'm telling you, as HUD secretary, and having been a developer and a planner, that's how it's going to be. Could it be any clearer what the purpose is of the current plans for restructuring of New Orleans? Now, Jackson didn't specify exactly which principles of planning and development require the removal of black people from cities where they're the majority. But he spoke in words that were consistent with the plans of both the Bush and the Clinton administrations in terms of housing for working people in New Orleans. Now, Jackson could have said things differently. He could have said it's unwise to rebuild in the lower Ninth Ward in areas that are flood prone, but that new housing throughout the city will be made available to all residents of New Orleans as required by the 1968 Fair Housing Law and the 1867 Civil Rights Act. He didn't explain why the administration is unwilling to give housing vouchers, but has an elaborate plan to give students vouchers to leave public schools and go to private schools. He didn't explain why the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which Alfonso Jackson heads, has ignored the 50 to 100 complaints per week, 50 to 100 complaints per week over the last 5 years of fair housing violations in the city of New Orleans reported to the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Council. And like his predecessors in the Clinton administration, Jackson has taken no action to address the findings of testing surveys about fair housing in New Orleans. One conducted by the New Orleans Fair Housing Council found that black apartment seekers were discriminated against 70% of the time in seeking housing. Attorneys representing the Fair Housing Council have won more than $1 million in actual and punitive damages for victims of housing discrimination, but the Bush administration's commitment to crime fighting has never included protecting black and Latino citizens of New Orleans from these illegal impediments to rentals and home ownership. Now, even before the Bush administration, the Clinton administration supervised the destruction of thousands of public housing units in New Orleans without adequate replacement. 8,000 fewer units in 2002 than in 1996. This convention center, where we've seen the inhumane conditions, conditions which, by the way, were tried out on Guantanamo Island on Haitian refugees throughout the 90s, and the same situations of people sitting in their own filth under carceral guard that took place in that convention center. This convention center sits on the site of the former St. Thomas housing project that used to house 1,000 black families. Like the St. Thomas neighborhood, like the Iberville neighborhood, like parts of the Treme, are being geared for urban renewal, and the hurricane is going to be used in as an excuse to continue this. When Hurricane Katrina devastated some of the public housing units remaining in New Orleans, Republican member of Congress Richard Baker from Baton Rouge announced jubilantly, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did it." Now, these observations by Secretary Jackson, Congressman Baker, resonate with the sentiments of Jimmy Reese, a wealthy white developer who directs the New Orleans Regional Transportation Authority at the appointment of Ray Nagin, even though he lives in Aspen, Colorado. Now, why is a white developer from Aspen directing transportation in a city three-quarters of which population is black? Reese told the Wall Street Journal that his plan for rebuilding New Orleans entailed preventing poor people from returning to their neighborhoods. And at Reese's urging, Mayor Nagin hosted a confidential meeting in Dallas less than 2 weeks after the hurricane hit with 40 white businessmen, two black elected officials, and Wynton Marsalis on the phone from New York. The 40 white businessmen, dubbed the 40 Thieves by leaders of grassroots community organizations, made plans for the city's future in the wake of the hurricane. Now, this meeting was chaired by Ray Nagin, a nominal Democrat, although he supported the conservative Bobby Jindal, a Bush appointee in the last gubernatorial election in New Orleans. The meeting was attended by representatives of Catherine Blanco, the Democratic governor of New Orleans, who has been looting revenues from the casino and the Superdome in order to lower taxes in the suburbs and outstate in Louisiana. But no representatives of legitimate community organizations were at this meeting. There was no one at the Dallas meeting who could change the focus from the richest to the brokest. No representative of the Douglas Community Coalition, a group attempting to turn Frederick Douglass High School into a community learning center. The mayor and his business backers did not act. Representatives from the Hands Off Iberville C3 Coalition that Gay mentioned did not ask representatives of Community Labor United, People Hurricane Relief, representatives of the Ernie K. Doe Community Center in the Treme neighborhood, Bob Moses' Algebra Project, or John O'Neill's Junebug Theater. Mayor Nagin and the business elite conducted their deliberations without hearing from any residents of the 9th Ward, from uptown black neighborhoods, and the 13th Ward, from the downtown 7th Ward Treme neighborhood, the oldest continuous free black neighborhood in the United States, or the West Bank neighborhoods in Algiers. Now, these plans for reconstructing New Orleans from the perspective of the richest reveal the terrible dearth of democracy in the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, and the United States. They are part and parcel of a global system that values white property more than black humanity, that places the pursuit of profits ahead of the preservation of coastal wetlands and the prevention of global warming, that imposes austerity on the poor while exacerbating the avarice of the rich. Changing the focus from the richest to the brokest would reveal something different, the determination of working people unwilling to let democracy die. 8 weeks before the hurricane, Allison Tutti Montana stood before the New Orleans City Council, and as representative of a group fraternal order in New Orleans, the Yellow Pocahontas Mardi Gras Indian tribe, Tutti Montana talked about the 5 instances of police murders of black young men in New Orleans since January. LaVon Jones in New Orleans, visiting New Orleans from Georgia Southern, beaten to death by bouncers at the Rezu Club on Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve. Jannard Nordy Thomas shot to death, 7 shots on Piety Street by police officers who claimed he had a gun, although no gun was found on him. And Allison Montana talked about 52 years of his own battles with the police. And he said that on March 19th, the police came and rousted the Mardi Gras Indians, claiming they had no permit to march. And he said they had been marching for 150 years without a permit, but the police came and tried to move them off the streets. And Tutti Montana raised his finger at the city council, and he said, "I want this to stop." And then he collapsed, fell to the floor. He died in front of the city council. Those were his last words: "I want this to stop." He represents a tradition of black self-activity, of direct democracy, of claiming the streets of New Orleans for black people. And I think that his example can teach us that democracy is not dead in New Orleans, that the seeds of democratic renewal are planted deeply in its soil. But shifting the focus from the richest to the brokest requires a lot from us. It'll take more than an opus to reverse this hypnosis. It requires hard work and sacrifice and struggle. It compels us to confront the people who actually run this country, and it forces us to face up to the selfishness, sadism, greed, contempt, and corruption of what is probably the most disgruntled, embittered, stingy, and angry agglomeration of haves in the history of the world. The first step for us ought to be to hear the words of Tutti Montana and to echo them, to look at what's been happening in this country and say, "I want this to stop."
Professor Lifshitz, thank you. Our next speaker is Professor Howard Winant, one of the most recognized experts in race relations. Professor Winant has co-authored one of the most important and most cited contemporary studies on the topic, a book entitled Racial Formation in the United States. A prodigious scholar, Professor Winant has made many crucial contributions to the fields of race studies, comparative historical sociology, political sociology, social theory, and human rights. His books include The New Politics of Race, Globalism, Difference, Justice, also The World is a Ghetto, and Racial Conditions, Politics, Theory, Comparisons. Professor Winant is housed in the Department of Sociology here on campus, although he travels many different venues. Please join me in welcoming Professor Howard Winant.
Well, I'm honored to be here with this panel, among this panel, and with you. And I also want to thank the Department of Black Studies and the Center for Black Studies, Claudine Michelle and Chris Yost, Dean Oliver, for organizing this panel. It's a funny thing, you go last, or almost last. I guess I'm not totally last. A lot of what I had to say has been said, and I think that's a good thing. We didn't plan with each other what we wanted to say. We just sort of independently come to a lot of the same points. And I know I see in George's presentation and his way of presenting the same kind of, controlled rage. I don't know how many people are feeling that. How much do we know about New Orleans already from all the exposure, all the discussion that we've had among ourselves, and yet the rage bubbles up when we see Nathan's out of the room, but I was really grateful for his presentation as well. I want to say something a little bit different from what we've said, although it's going to overlap. And it's a political statement that I guess I want to make. It goes a little bit beyond our tendency to believe that this was a case of malfeasance and error. Let me start with this. The Bush administration knows everything there is to know about preparing for hurricanes. Everything. As Richard Clark pointed out recently, 1 year ago, before Hurricane Francis hit Florida, the administration, the federal and the national administration, pre-positioned in Florida thousands of trucks filled with gas, water, ice, medicine, and food, as well as other supplies for the state of Florida. It mobilized 4,000 National Guard troops. The war in Iraq was already going on in Florida, and flew in about the same number of emergency aid workers and first responders from around the country. It brought in and pre-positioned 5 million ready-to-serve meals to Florida. And it set up scores of mobile satellite-based communication centers. So this, I guess this might have been separate phones or maybe little stations on with power supplies, I'm not sure, so that rescuers and responders could communicate about their activities one with the other. Finally, it worked with and helped coordinate all this in advance. The Red Cross, the Salvation Army, and other non-governmental groups who offered this kind of assistance. This was in September of 2004, not exactly the ancient past. 2 months before the presidential election, Florida was a swing state, 27 crucial electoral votes, and hanging in the balance, possibly did actually vote Democratic, although we'll never know in the 2004 election. In sharp contrast to the vacationing or vacant Bush during Katrina, as Clark himself says, in the aftermath of Hurricane Francis, Bush was on hand in Florida along with his brother, the governor. Quote, the president himself passed out water bottles to Floridians driven from their homes. That's sort of my first point. The second point is that there's a sort of an inevitable conclusion that we can draw, I think, from this comparison, which is that Bush and his administration very deliberately did not plan for Katrina. It's not an error. It's not malfeasance. I mean, it's not a mistake. It is malfeasance. It's not who they appointed and didn't appoint. I mean, all those things may be involved marginally. But in fact, there is a decision here. There's a cause here that we have to face. And that is the destruction of New Orleans was not a mistake. It was a deliberate policy of neglect. And that's what we have to explain. We have to do a lot of other work, too. As George is saying, we have to talk about what the response will be. We have to look at the kind of response that is being generated. But we have to explain how this is possible in a supposedly democratic society. The people of New Orleans who could not flee and thus were abandoned to their fate, the poor, the largely black, but not entirely black, many white poor, many Latino poor, many undocumented Latino poor, all live in, not all, but many live in the low-lying areas of a city that's already below sea level in many places. These people are not Republican constituents. They vote Democratic to the extent that they vote. They're poor and thus unproductive, quote-unquote, not major taxpayers. And in fact, they're consumers of social services to the extent that social services remain available to them. They are, as has been pointed out, among the poorest and most neglected citizens of the United States. It would be not far-fetched to say that they are citizens in name only. They lack the rights of citizens as well as human rights. Now, there are endless accounts, we've heard some, many more, of willful abandonment, of fecklessness, of greed, of neglect that have emerged from the ruins left by Katrina. The documented abandonment of inmates in jails and locked cells, not all of them, by the way, even convicted, not all of them even charged, by guards and police who left their posts in flagrant dereliction of their duties. That stands kind of as an apt metaphor, in my view, for the practices of the national administration in respect to the largely black, Latino, and poor sections of New Orleans. Okay, the third point is that if you follow my argument thus far, in dealing with the administration's acquiescence, if not outright facilitation of Katrina's destruction of the poor and largely black neighborhoods of New Orleans, we are in fact dealing, I'm grateful to Gay Johnson for stealing my thunder and using this phrase before me, we are in fact dealing with something like a policy of ethnic cleansing. And this is just a few words I have to say about how we explain what this is about. And again, it is going to overlap a lot with what George just ran down. Katrina may have been bad for the people of New Orleans, the majority of the people, but it was good not only for the white and wealthy upper class of New Orleans, it was good for capital in a general way. And we have to take note of that as a principle that has more application than just New Orleans. Destruction is a necessary element in capitalist accumulation. Just as war is good for capital because it destroys old, fixed capital, forces its replacement, creates new opportunities for investment, usually subsidized publicly, and thus a source for extra profit-making, super profits. Just as depression, economic depression, is good for capital for the same reason, because it destroys fixed capital, creates new opportunities for investment, usually subsidized, etc. So too is disaster on a massive scale good for capital. It's good for capital in the sense that it generates not only the opportunities I'm talking about for investment and profit making, but it generates a rationale for the obliteration of democratic control of the public sphere. There's a lot of evidence that this is what was going on, what is going on in New Orleans, and what was in fact planned to go on in some respects. Again, it was not necessary to have the level of destruction in New Orleans that happened. I have this very same quote that you had, George, from Richard Baker. I'll just say it again. We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did. And here's another quote. This is from a Republican congressman from New Orleans, Mike Pierce, who was one of the people that Bush turned to when, after having kind of hit out or refused to say anything systematic about the aftermath of the hurricane, he went to New Orleans to deliver the speech that he gave in Jackson Square, supposedly the speech that was supposed to be a stirring recommitment to the city and the people. Mike Pierce was one of the people with whom Bush consulted in preparing that speech. Congressman Pierce, he said, "We want to turn the Gulf Coast into a magnet for free enterprise. The last thing we want is a federal city where New Orleans once was." So that's what the administration wants. That's what the ethnic cleansers want. But what do the people of New Orleans want? That's the question that we have to answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Howard, for your comments. Our final panelist is Professor William Freudenberg. He is a professor in the Environmental Studies program here at UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Freudenberg has devoted most of his career to the study of environment-society relationships. He's particularly well known both for his work on coupled environment-society systems in general and for his work on more specific topics, including resource-dependent communities, the social impacts of environmental and technological change, and risk analysis. He has held official positions with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Sociological Association, and the National Academy of Sciences, among others. He is the winner of awards from the American Sociological Association, the Rural Sociological Society, the Pacific Sociological Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Dr. Freudenberg is the current president of the Rural Sociological Society. Please join me in welcoming him.
Or, as they say, last, and in this case, probably least. I'll be probably less articulate than several of the people you've just heard from. I was once accused, and I'm stalling in case you can't tell while I try to unhook Nathan's computer and hook mine in. I was once accused by my students at the University of Wisconsin of being not just a middle-of-the-roader, but a middle-aged, middle-class middle-of-the-roader from the Middle West. And had to decide that I basically resembled that remark. Now, if the technology works, you should see my screen coming up here very soon. Yes, you do. as I said, this will be perhaps a little less stirring than some of the people you've heard from, but it doesn't really undercut much of what you've heard. A lot of my friends and I have been saying for many years that New Orleans was a calamity waiting to happen, and eventually it didn't wait. I didn't wait any longer. I'm going to be saying today that Katrina was actually four disasters, the first of which really was something that God did. It really was a major hurricane. Here are some shots from Port Sulphur down below New Orleans along the Mississippi River from about a week and a half ago. It came through in a major, major way and did all kinds of serious damage. Both of those houses weren't on the road earlier. Even big houses got moved. But I want to move off of just the natural disaster part and talk next about some of the ways in which this was an unnatural disaster. The second disaster is that our defenses, as you've heard very eloquently, failed. The physical defenses failed and the organizational defenses failed, even worse. You've probably all heard, this is from the Washington Post, this is the 17th Street Canal, one of the canals that gave way in a relatively affluent neighborhood. Here's the same picture, or the same area, taken from a picture that widely circulated on the internet. And what happened was that after the levees failed, as you heard from Nathan at the start, well, nothing happened. The water kept coming in, it kept rising, and the misery kept rising. The bigger problem, in my way of thinking, is that it wasn't just the immediate physical defenses, but the organizational defenses. In the 30 years that I've been looking at disasters of various sorts, this was clearly the worst response I've ever seen in the United States. One of my friends down there said it was supposed to be an organized emergency response. It wasn't organized, it wasn't on an emergency basis, and it really wasn't even a response. Now, as Nathan pointed out earlier, there was a response, and a fairly impressive one, from the rural people of Mississippi, many of whom are not black, many of whom were just going in to help fellow human beings, and the one race they cared about was the human race. There were heroes locally, the youngest of whom and was featured in the Los Angeles Times, DeMonte Love. He was told by his mother to look after all of these other little kids because a couple of mothers and their kids were all together. The helicopters were able to rescue the kids first, but not the moms. They didn't quite get back to get the moms. They were eventually reunited, by the way. But DeMonte promised his mom he'd look after these other little kids who were younger than his 6 years, and he did. So there was heroism. There's also some organized and appropriate response. Tulane Hospital. This picture is from a friend, Gaynell, who is one of the nurses at Tulane Hospital who stayed there to the bitter end. The company that owned Tulane Hospital, a big capitalist enterprise, chartered helicopters. They were old, as Nathan pointed out, but they were helicopters. And the staff there evacuated the sickest people first and themselves, including Gaynell, last. Power, as you know, went out. A lot of the folks in the hospital were too sick to go to walk, and they couldn't use the elevators. Somebody figured out, well, let's use the pickup trucks that are over in the garage that's attached to the hospital. They kept using the pickup trucks, putting one or two people in the bed of a pickup truck, taking it up to the roof of the parking garage, and then flying them out by helicopter. They kept on going until they ran out of gasoline, siphoned some more gasoline out of some more vehicles, and then kept going. And when the corporation had evacuated all of their own people, they then donated the helicopters to a charity hospital, which didn't have any of this kind of financial backup. They showed something that is a truism in the field of disaster research, which is that the essence of disaster management is not a military structure, but artful counterpunching, dealing with the surprises you get. The federal government wasn't all bad. The Weather Service did its job. We think of the Weather Service as having really boring announcements. But when they say, you know, you're going to be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer, they were making very, very scary claims, which is one of the reasons that at least the affluent people and the mobile people of New Orleans evacuated. I would say that the Coast Guard basically did its job as well. They moved their equipment out of the way because they knew the hurricane was coming. They moved in afterwards, although they didn't have lots of helicopters. They did have some, and they probably evacuated between 300 and 700 people, including some of the people who needed it the most, according to various people I've talked to. And they did it all with promptness and I would say even a degree of heroism in the amount of dedication they showed. In part, that's because they weren't using the military top-down technique. They were using the time-honored Coast Guard tradition of rescue people first and then ask for permission later. But when it comes to FEMA and Homeland Security, you heard our Mayor Bloom talk about how they weren't doing such a good job. Actually, I think she was too diplomatic. FEMA and Homeland Security were nowhere to be found while people were stranded for days. The first 3 days after a disaster is when people start dying from thirst, from lack of medicine, from needing to be rehooked up to their dialysis machines. There was no response in the first 3 days, and people got increasingly desperate, waiting. These are images, as you can tell, from Time and Washington Post. The local emergency management director called it a national disgrace. And I'd have a hard time disagreeing with him. This picture, by the way, from the Santa Barbara Press, the guy there holding his little baby is also providing a bit of dignity to someone at the other end of the life who died while waiting to be evacuated. This woman died while waiting. Time, Washington Post, two people who died while waiting. Time again, someone else who died while waiting. When the response came, it was a very militaristic response. Notice how desperate those people are to get that water that's finally just being tossed off the helicopters. It was a little bit as if the Coast Guard, or excuse me, the National Guard was invading Iraq again. A very heavy military presence with people going around in SWAT team vehicles, but not really stopping for the residents who were trying to get some genuine help. What they found when they got in there was, lo and behold, as you've just heard from other people on the panel, it wasn't quite the war zone that they'd heard about. They met a lot of people who weren't violent. They were desperate. That's the second disaster. Our response has failed. The third disaster, which we learned is actually took place first, but we only learned about it as we learned more in afterwards, is that in many ways this wasn't something that God did. It was something that humans did to create the disaster in the first place. We sometimes want to blame Bienville, who founded New Orleans, the Crescent City, because it was only on a small crescent along the natural levee of the Mississippi a couple hundred years ago. Actually, it was a pretty clever place to put it. It's about 100 miles in from the mouth of the Mississippi, which is way down here. But it's a useful place because you could bypass that bottom 100 miles or so of the river coming in through Lake Pontchartrain and getting into New Orleans from the north. And it was protected from the Gulf by 50 or 70 miles of wetlands. But what happens if you take muddy water that's all shook up and moving and let it sit for a while is that a little bit of silt settles out. And that's basically why all of that wetlands was down there. There have been levee building eras over the past 5,000 years that we can document fairly readily, and longer than that probably, that overall would have been, the Mississippi would continue to meander back and forth as the channel silts up, making a real delta, like a triangle, except for the fact that we decided, as Mark Twain once put it, that we knew better than God where that river ought to go. So we started making huge investments in levee building back in the 30s and 40s, which did reduce the number of floods. But what we've found as we've continued to pour more money into these levees is that the actual damage, even controlling for inflation, has gone up. We have not learned our lesson, and these numbers are well before you factor in Katrina costing possibly $200 billion. The reason is you've got all of this mud that's, you know, now a nuisance in New Orleans, that instead of piling up and replenishing the marsh and building it up slowly an inch or two at a time, half a foot in a big flood, is instead being shot over the edge of the continent. From this picture, if you look for very long, you can see what's wrong. And what it is that the right side is supposed to be the low side. But notice where the water level is. On the dry side that's protected from the flooding in the marsh, what we tend to have here and in lots of other places is the land sinking. So that instead of building up the marsh and keeping that marsh healthy, which protected New Orleans for hundreds of years, what we have is losing Louisiana. We've lost about 5 acres of Louisiana since you walked in here this afternoon, if normal averages are continuing. So the net effect is that Bienville, when he first came in, picked the Crescent City, which was above sea level and still is barely, and there are some other areas of New Orleans that are still relatively high and stayed somewhat dry, but most of New Orleans is now a kind of a bowl that's below sea level. Part of the reason, though, it's not just New Orleans that's sinking, it's also the wetlands that are disappearing. And some of the projections say that if we have global warming added to it, there's going to be no wetland area at all to the south of New Orleans in just a few more years. And by the way, if you look at the area that they thought would stay wetlands, if you look at what Katrina did, that's disappearing pretty rapidly too. Now, when Katrina, for those of you who don't know this, the part of the hurricane you worry about the most is the white arrow on the right, the eastern and north edge of the hurricane close to the eye. That's where the wind is the heaviest. That's what pushes the storm surge the hardest. When the hurricane was getting close to New Orleans, it looked as though it would go just a little bit to the left, just a little bit to the west. And that's when some people started to say, my gosh, we could lose New Orleans. It shifted just a little bit to the right. And I remember saying to my wife on Sunday, my gosh, we could lose New Orleans. And then on Monday morning when I'd heard it shifted to the right, oh, it looks like they dodged the bullet again, just like they have a bunch of times in the past. But this time, I was wrong. The early media reports said that it was a nasty hurricane, but we didn't have the flooding that was feared. Even by the time that report came out, though, it was wrong. And it was wrong in part because of something that people couldn't see if they were staying in the French Quarter. Here's a NASA overview of the city of New Orleans. The Superdome is in the lower center there. The main curve of the river the Crescent City Crescent. The original city is about right here. You may have heard of two canals. One is the 17th Street Canal along here. Notice this side wet, this side dry. Only one side, the New Orleans side, broke. Jefferson Parish stayed dry. The other you haven't heard quite as much about is the Inner Harbor Canal or the Industrial Canal. And something you've heard almost nothing about, unless you've talked with me, is that there was a huge source of flooding that affected the lower Ninth Ward, which is 98% black, a high poverty level, but also a high home ownership level, 45%, and St. Bernard Parish, which is right next to it, and almost exactly the same demographic characteristics, except it's well over 90% white and 45% home ownership level. Those areas got the worst damage from Katrina, in part because of something you haven't heard about. Here's a picture of the 17th Street Canal before and after from Digital Globe. You notice there is a little bit of damage on the right side, but not a whole lot, actually. Here is a picture of the Industrial Canal breach from the Washington Post. Contrary to what the caption at the bottom says, that's not water coming from the canal into the neighborhood. It's water coming from the neighborhood into the canal, because it was so much deeper in the neighborhood than it was in the canal. How did that happen? Well, here's an Earth Google picture of a gate before, and here's a NOAA picture of the same gate after, a couple days after the storm. You notice something strange there? What used to be dirt on the right side of that gate is gone. There is, if you go to the southeast of that spot, there is extensive damage all the way along what used to be a 17-foot tall levee. There are industrial barges on the wrong side of the levee and into the marsh. All along that area of one of the levees, there is all kinds of damage. And the reason is that's where two Army Corps of Engineers pork barrel projects come together. One is the east-west one, known as the Intercoastal Waterway, which actually does get used fairly heavily for shipping purposes. The other one is that Mr. GO, stands for Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. It's where those two big levees come together. You have basically the mouth of a funnel. According to the official policy report from the Army Corps of Engineers, this yellow spot, which is where that big gash was, was deliberately cut afterwards to let the marsh drain out. And these other blue stars just to the right of it are damage of unknown origin. I suggest that if they can't figure out what caused that damage, they really shouldn't be using our tax money to play with water. The storm surge, which is what a hurricane pushes in front of it, came right up Mr. GO, and the winds howling out of the northeast at about 130 miles an hour drove it straight across that levee, and it drove barges and all kinds of other stuff across the levee too. So that at this spot, known as the Paris Street Bridge or the Highway 47 Bridge, this is what it looked like. This is a picture taken during the hurricane. This is widely circulated on the internet. I believe it is actually a legit picture. That's not one wave, but as you can see from the added comments here, there is a levee that's underneath there. Why did it all happen? Well, this Mr. GO. You haven't heard of it, perhaps, unless you've paid attention to New Orleans and Louisiana, but this was a big ditch, more dirt than the Panama Canal. It's basically just parallel to the river. And the idea was this was going to be as busy as the 101 freeway during rush hour with all kinds of shipping traffic. It never has been that busy, but what it has done is let a lot of salt water get into a freshwater marsh where it's killing off the cypress trees and the other plants that used to hold the marsh together. And according to the people who live there and been trying to get it shut down for 20 years, it's a superhighway for storm surges. Now, the reason it was built supposedly is economic development, but the real numbers are that you and I and our fellow taxpayers put in $13.4 million last year just to dredge it, and we did that for about one ship a day, and that's if you count one-way trips, fewer than 400 trips all year in 2004. So that amounts to about $35,000 per one-way trip. So, you've heard about two kinds of looting, right? There was the understandable looting of the people who, you know, took water and food, and then there was the regrettable looting of people who took plasma TVs. Here is one of the supposed looters. I have lots of other pictures of the 64-year-old woman, etc. What you haven't heard about, though, is a third form of looting that's actually the oldest. That Mr. Go, which was going to be supposedly a helpful explosion for world trade, if you believe the local boosters, even before we consider the cost of Katrina, cost taxpayers $35,000 per one-way trip, $70,000 every time one boat went up and then back down again, Mr. Go. That's our taxpayer dollars at work, and if it weren't for Mr. Go, a lot of the people who died and are now homeless wouldn't be dead or homeless. So, here is the 17th Street Canal again, the one that's close to rich people's homes. This is what it looks like as about a week ago. You may even recognize that house on the right from one of Nathan's pictures. You know, it did wipe out three or four houses by the time it was all over, and they were pretty big houses. But compare that to what happened then at the Industrial Canal. Now, the Industrial Canal isn't as pretty, but it is, by my sense, brief interpretation, better built. But this is the back side of it. The other side of it, to your left, is where the Industrial Canal is. What you can see is that all the way along this side of the wall, the water came right over the top. That 17th Street Canal wall failed without the water getting within 4 or 5 feet of the top. Clearly here, what has happened is the water came right over the top. That's a top for a bottom for a table there, by the way. So that's probably about 30 inches deep. Overall, this gets to about 5 or 6 feet deep. Here, the same spot, looking the other direction. Notice, water clearly has come over this all the way along here. Friend of mine, just for a sense of height, it's almost 5 to 6 feet deep here. And if you look to his right and ahead, you see what happened where the ditch got a little bit bigger, which is that entire wall, even though it's better made than the one in the rich people's district, just completely slumped over and shot away from there. There is nothing left standing for 4 to 5 blocks. These were very densely populated urban neighborhoods, houses 3, 4, 5 feet apart, and there's nothing left from them for 4 and 5 blocks away where the water came shooting through. You haven't heard about this neighborhood very much because this wasn't where the reporters were staying. But this is where the really serious damage took place. And this is where it was instantaneous, where the water didn't rise just inches per hour, but 10 to 15 feet in a matter of 15 minutes. There's by the way, one of the barges that you may have seen. It's sitting on top of a school bus. Floated around for a while. This was obviously a cinder block wall. That's all that's left of it. Here we're about 2 blocks away from what would have been the wall. Here we're about 6 blocks away. Here's where you start to see some chunks of concrete and brick that finally stopped flowing on the tremendous water. I want to stop with, though, a couple more barriers. Here is the barrier between the Lower Ninth Ward and St. Bernard Parish. The other side of that barrier is New Orleans. This side, it's officially a different county, St. Bernard Parish. We originally saw this. We thought it was to keep people from entering the Lower Ninth Ward that had the most severe damage. In fact, there is only one spot where you can get in. And here is a picture of... and my other picture is gone. There may be another picture that will show up where the PowerPoint gods moved it. But basically, this is where we went in to the Lower Ninth Ward. We were with some folks from the University of New Orleans doing a damage assessment. Thank you, Shirley Laska. They let us right in with no problem. But we thought it was a checkpoint to keep us from getting in. In fact, we learned the hard way when we were coming out and almost wound up some of those jail statistics that this is a barrier to keep people from getting out again. And there, even though there's no one living in the Lower Ninth Ward, they're only now starting to be allowed back in. There is such paranoia about trying to keep those black folks from the other side out that we almost got arrested for not driving slowly enough and politely enough when we came out. We're probably going 8 miles an hour. So, four disasters, I would say. And the fourth one, by the way, is underway as we speak. Gaze started talking about how fast the government did move when it came to handing money to Halliburton and some other folks for doing some of the rebuilding. But what they have not done so far as I can tell, is to notice that really what Katrina did was not just to create third world economic conditions, but as you may have heard from one of the benefits, to reveal the third world conditions that were already there. And that's something we need to do a better job of coping with in the future. Thank you.
I want to thank our panelists. And we had hoped to have some time for questions, and I'm hoping it would be possible to go over 4:30 or not. Okay. Maybe a moment or two of questions among the panelists, and I would like to indulge in the first, which is to follow up on a general theme, which is what is to be done, I believe, in many of your presentations, and to ask specifically about democracy and money, because it seems to me that one point of struggle now is spending oversight. But there's a great deal at stake, obviously, and what happens with the $200 billion, Professor Freudenberg, that you just referenced. So I'm wondering if any of you have comments to offer in terms of what's happening, particularly in Congress, in the battles over just how transparent bidding will be, priorities for future development, and so forth. So I leave that question to anyone who would like any.
There's going to be a national meeting in Jackson, Mississippi, December 9th and 10th, on the right to return. And it will be followed by a march on New Orleans in preparation for demanding a democratic rebuilding of the city. The People's Hurricane Relief Committee and Community Labor United are the two main groups behind this. You can get on the web and find Community Labor United, People's Hurricane Relief Fund. They are attempting not only to meet the immediate needs of people who are suffering, but trying to establish a democratic basis for rebuilding New Orleans. Everyone who feels that would be a good outcome can contact their elected officials, especially members of the House of Representatives and members of the Senate, and voice your support for the democratic rebuilding of New Orleans, built around the right to return, the right to rebuild, and the right to be safe in your person.
If I could add to that, when I was speaking yesterday with some of the people from some of the coalitions in New Orleans, they were saying that they want to establish a network of friends around the country, and I told them about this forum that was happening. They were very excited, and they asked me to announce that they need someone who could work long distance to do a web page for them. And so if there's anybody who might be able to do that, if you'd like to let me know, I can give you the phone number of the person who requested that. But they also said that they are planning a national march that has to do with all of these horrible things that have happened in New Orleans, and to bring attention to, as Jay Arena had said, this new kind of racism. And they are doing that, and they want to make it clear because they feel like the things that have happened in New Orleans are everybody's problem, because these are the kinds of methods and strategies that have always been used but are being used in such blatant relief at this point. And so they want to make it clear that, you know, if they have this problem, then all oppressed people are going to have this problem all over the world. And this is the major message of this national march, and they hope to have it in January. So, again, if people are interested, then please do let me know.
And apropos of contacting your legislative representatives, it's worth noting we're still in a state that has a majority Democratic state legislature and locally we have a Democratic congressperson and two Democratic senators statewide. But the effort is on to change that locally, that is to say on a state level, and that is the special election, especially Proposition 77, which will remove from the legislature the right to carry out redistricting and put that in basically in a sort of a kingly fashion in the governor's hands, and a white and old and wealthy, undoubtedly, a committee of senators, of retired judges who will then supervise redistricting. This may seem to be far from New Orleans, but it's not. If we want to have democracy in this state and we want to be able to affect national policy decisions about social spending, we better fight to maintain a democratic process of electoral politics in this state. So we better vote on November 8th, not just for Proposition 77, against Proposition 77, but on the other anti-democratic measures that are on the ballot as well.
Very good. I would invite the panelists, if you have questions for each other, you're welcome to put those on the floor now. Otherwise, I can open it to anybody from the audience. Do you all have questions for each other?
No? These folks have been very patient.
We don't have time for very many. One or two questions from the floor, and then again, you'll have an opportunity to speak with the panelists during the session afterwards. Is there anyone who would like to speak? And I ask you again to please come to the microphones at the front of the theater if you're interested. Please.
Thank you for coming and talking about this. In the 1980s, I was an activist involved in some of the national attention that was being given to homelessness at that time. And then in the 1990s, before I moved to Santa Barbara, I lived and worked in Los Angeles, where I witnessed Skid Row and that problem of homelessness there. And then when I came back here and went to college, I learned about environmental racism and the toxic conditions killing poor people of color in the South. And in my mind, Katrina just makes more acute all of these problems. And I'm wondering if you can respond to how the language of emergency serves to disconnect these events and kind of separate them into groups that are, some are criminalized and some are victimized, and how can we bridge those differences and create a common discourse where we can talk about this willful neglect and these kinds of ethnic cleansings? Thank you.
This is a terrific question, because what we have, as many of the speakers have pointed out, has been a steady process of organized abandonment of vulnerable populations, and not simply abandonment, but also a kind of plunder that has benefited specific interests in this society. You mentioned the homelessness and environmental justice issues especially. I think what we see here is not a disconnected series of incidents, but rather a kind of apocalypse on the installment plan. It doesn't happen all at once, but the noose tightens with every form of privatization. You look at Louisiana in the 1930s and 40s, as segregated as it was, Louisiana had better public services than any state in the South, and even equal to some states in the North. And it's because they had a huge public works program based on taxing Standard Oil. Huey Long's position was, if you don't want the oil in Louisiana, go somewhere else. But if you want the oil in Louisiana, you have to pay in order to play. And there was a lot wrong with the way those benefits were distributed, but there was an important infrastructure. Louisiana is in many ways a model over the last five decades of what happens when you have a kind of free market fundamentalism that removes a sense of general responsibility. It isn't good to abandon the most vulnerable. It's a good idea to take care of people who are vulnerable. It's a good idea not to have cancer rates 4 and 8 times the national average, as there are in what's known as Cancer Alley, this series of chemical plants between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. You go to the airport, and instead of steps now, there are ramps. And that's because people in the disability movement sued. They said, well, those steps are hard for us. And we put those ramps in now, and everybody takes those ramps. You know, because they're easier. It's a good idea. You take care of those with the greatest need. You help everybody. And in the instances where this nation and other nations have done that, you invest in the infrastructure. What we're doing is the opposite. It's like eating the seed corn. It's like destroying the possibility of taking care of each other so that each disaster that comes then becomes more expensive and more difficult to deal with.
If I could add something, this will be probably a little less stirring, but maybe useful as a way of talking about how we think about things. Years ago, it was very common to talk about disasters as un-events. They're unnatural, unnormal, unfortunate, they're beyond the realm of normalcy, etc. And the job of the people we call authorities was to move in afterwards and say, everybody be calm, we'll be fine, we're going to go back to normal here. And that allowed... Basically, the argument is that a lot of folks who, wear white folks who wear ties, worked out a deal with society that you give us high prestige and a reasonably high level of income, and we'll give you at least the belief that you can control the scourges of the ages. And every now and then something like Katrina comes on, or Wilma today, that reminds us that maybe nature still bats last. But it's very important for us to sort of restore that fiction that, in fact, we control things and that this was just a little aberration. What leaked out in the case of Katrina wasn't just contaminated flood water. It was a little bit about truth, about power, about injustice, about fairness in America that many Americans had forgotten all about. But we may have a chance here in California to restore the balance just a little bit, because guess what is the other main area of the United States that's below sea level, protected by faulty old seawalls, except in the Central Delta. 4 feet below sea level, we're now talking about major housing developments with 4 and 5 bedroom houses, very expensive things, going in right in the Delta. Our governor, who has a very good environmental record in some areas, decided that he was going to get rid of the entire board that looks after the levee system because they were being too pesky to builders who wanted to develop new houses. I don't know if it's related to the fact that a quarter of his campaign contributions came from real estate development interests, but some people have made that connection. And we in California, right in the wake of Katrina, have the opportunity, if we want, to repeat New Orleans's experience, but to do it with rich people's homes. I personally think it's a bad idea whether we're talking about rich people's homes or poor people's homes, but if we fail to learn the lesson from Katrina, even in the case of affluent people in the Delta, maybe it suggests that capitalists can't be quite as smart as some of the folks on this panel want to think.
Can I just add one other quick thing to this? These are all really valuable points. The California breadbasket is shipping through a lot of the Central Valley of California, exporting our agricultural produce, a great deal of the U.S. agricultural produce through the Port of Oakland. But the other main place where agricultural produce is exported, and of course the materials to produce that agricultural produce is imported, is the Mississippi River, i.e. the Port of New Orleans, which is responsible, I believe, I don't have this figure in front of me, but something like 80% of the, I'm sorry, 40% of the agricultural exports in the United States. Now, I'm not as well informed as Bill Freudenberg on this, but my understanding from what I read is that the port facilities in New Orleans are largely intact in the aftermath of the hurricane and the flooding, but the workers are absent. Now, the march on New Orleans that George is talking about, the direct action is really a crucial element of this, but we also have to think about the class structure of New Orleans and the working class in New Orleans. And what does this mean, not only for the city, but for the country and the world? The short-sightedness and greed of the policies that we've been talking about, allowing the city to be destroyed, have absolutely global implications and incredible political and economic implications for the future of the American economy. And just as a last point on that, New Orleans, for all its racial conflicts, has this incredibly complicated nuanced racial history in terms of the working class, and especially the dock workers of New Orleans, who staged in 1919, was it, George? I think the most an absolutely unanticipated, unprecedented interracial strike. I mean, in the heart of Jim Crow segregation, in the depths of the U.S. South, defending the rights of workers across racial lines. I mean, this is fairly relevant in terms of this march to New Orleans, and also about the planning and so on that's going to go on. If it's not class conscious as well as race conscious, it's not only going to be, you know, the tourist trap New Orleans in the future that they you know, these people we've been talking about want to build. It's also going to be, and in many respects, possibly will be, the end of the American Midwest agricultural capacity in the United States. So it's a little long-term planning, a little connection between economic and political issues on that level, and democratic reconstruction, you know, is warranted there as well.